the pod, I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to another Empire Podcast special. Hans Zimmer is quite simply one of the finest composers working in cinema today. From humble beginnings as the composer of the theme tune for hit BBC daytime quiz Going for Gold, Hans really has gone for gold, oh Jesus Christ, working indelibly with the likes of Christopher Nolan, Ridley Scott, Terrence Malick, Denis Villeneuve, Zack Snyder, Steve McQueen, James L. Brooks, Michael Bay, and more over the decades. Along the way, of course, he's won 2 Oscars and been nominated for many more. Basically, Hans Zimmer knows what he's doing. And he also knows his way around the live arena, carving out a reputation over the last few years as one of the best live acts around, taking his musical mates around the world, putting together a set list of pure movie magic that frankly is hard to top. In fact, he has just announced a new album, Hans Zimmer Live. Sorry, misread that. Hans Zimmer Live, which will come out on March 3rd, 2023. And his latest tour, Hans Zimmer Live, is heading to the UK next June, with dates at the O2 in London on June 14th and 15th, and Manchester Arena on June 16th. And he's going to Dublin next June as well, which is going to be lovely. Maybe he'll play Going for Gold. Heck, I'd finish with that, quite frankly. Anyway, he's very much in live music mode at the moment, and so when we heard that he was in town last week and up for a chat, we jumped at the chance to talk to the great man about his live life, about translating his music to a gig setting, putting together the perfect set list, and much, much more. And when I say we, I mean Amon Warman, who is such a huge Hans Zimmer fan that he was frankly the only choice for the gig. If I'd sent someone else, Amon would have come after me personally. So here you go, Amon Warman's in-depth chat with the great Hans Zimmer. And no, he didn't ask about Going for Gold. If you ask me, Amon is still playing catch-up. Ask your parents about that reference. Enjoy.
We are delighted to be joined on this very special episode of the Empire Podcast by the composer of Gladiator, my favorite score of all time. Also The Dark Knight, also Batman Begins, also The Lone Ranger, also Man of Steel, and many more besides. Mr. Hans Zimmer.
What, you thought other than Gladiator the rest was rubbish?
That is not what I am saying.
All right.
We are here to talk about your live album, which you're doing. And you've made 2 live albums previously. How does this third one differ from what's come before?
The reason we're doing it, we did this album is just because the band has sort of gotten tighter, and we've spent more time figuring out what we can actually get away with and can do. So it's a bit more experimental. It's a bit more out there, and it's just, you know, we've taken a little bit more care about the arrangements, etc. The other thing which I think is different is there's an energy that you love about a live album, but usually they're not that well recorded. You know, it's hard to find one that's really well recorded. Mm-hmm. And in this case, we actually went, I said to Stephen Lipson, who mixed this album, who's, you know, the amazing engineer, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Grace Jones, all the Jeff Beck albums, you know, you name it. I mean, it's just great, brilliant producer, engineer. I said to him, don't necessarily make it like a live album. Make it like, you know, it pops out of your speakers and whacks you in the chest. You know, let's have, as opposed to that sort of the distance a live album usually has. I want this to be a great sounding record. So I think he managed to do that.
Awesome.
In fact, I know he did.
One thing I think you get to do live is to put a new spin on your original music in ways that you're just not able to do initially in the track, right?
Well, it's sort of yes and no. You know, there are certain things like okay, I'll give you the best worst example. The opening to The Lion King. My friend Lebo, we did that in, oh God, did we do it 93? Something like that. It's a blessing and a curse. I mean, when I found Lebo, he was washing cars in a garage in the valley in Los Angeles. And now he's, you know, But he is known for this thing. And, you know, I mean, he so would like to do this differently. You know, it's just one evening, just go and freak out and just maybe not do this. But it's literally his calling card right now. Mm-hmm. You know, and so of course I have to get, I'm making him do it. And then after that, I let him do whatever he wants to do, you know, but we got to have this. So there's a certain expectation that we have to fulfill. And so when I originally planned the tour and I put the set list together, it was different people tell me different things. It was either 7 hours long or it was 5 hours long. But whichever way you look at it, you weren't going to catch that last train home. And you were going to have a miserable time standing in the rain. So we managed to get it down. And I just went radical. I just made a sort of a radical decision, which was, you know, one track for you, one track for me, you know, quite simple. You know, this is what the audience wants to hear, and this is something that I really want to play. And sometimes they coincided, you know, there's that. And the other thing is I gave the audience the respect that they deserved, because everybody was going, you know, a modern audience has an attention span of a gnat. you know, it's like, you got to make things short. You can't, you know, and, you know, Pirates is like 14 minutes long, and you know, things like Dune, etc. I mean, those are sort of expansive pieces, you know, and Lion King, yes, you get that thing at the beginning, but then you get a whole new arrangement of everything else, and yeah, it's not short, you know. There's a lot of stuff there that wants saying. I mean, Interstellar. I mean, there are bits which, you know, I don't think anybody's ever heard live, you know, and I just wanted to do them. There are things, you know, of movies that weren't a huge big success, but musically they're fun to play, you know, and it's about the musicians. I mean, I think I'm not bragging about me, I'm bragging about them. I'm bragging about that I think I have the best band in the world at the moment. I mean, I have phenomenal musicians, and I want them to be heard, and I want them to have an opportunity to stretch out a little bit.
When you're crafting scores for various films, how much are you thinking about, yes, I want this to work in the body of the film, but I also want it to work on its lonesome? Because I think that's part of the reason why you're able to have a live show, as opposed to some of the scores I listen to, like, it really works together for the film. I'm not sure I'd be excited to listen to that on its own.
It's actually a really good question. I mean, I think one of my jobs is to add something to the film that can stand on its own two feet autonomously, mm-hmm. Add a bit of excitement and do something like that. And then at the same time, yes, there'll be scenes where I'll be sitting back where I'm trying to just, I'm doing anything and everything to get out of the way of, you know, somebody's acting, somebody's performance. But there are other scenes where, you know, I get to grab the reins of the thing. Mm-hmm. So, no, not everything works, but I think everything should be played and created and made with, you know, with commitment and with a certain amount of recklessness and with a certain amount of sort of, you know, it's not background music. It certainly is not, mm-hmm. you know, and I mean, and I suppose, you know, like the compliment is, you know, when a Chris Nolan, who has written the words in the screenplay, is burying his words in the music, you know, and okay, people are getting annoyed about this sometimes. And what they don't realize is actually Chris gives you the information very clearly three times in the film. So if you don't hear it one time because he lets the music give you an emotional version of the information, you know, just go with it. You know, it's an experience. It's not a math lesson.
I agree. So how do you shape the set list for a show like this?
I knew I wanted to start with something weird and something new. And I thought it'd be daring to have Loire, who sings on Dune. I thought, first of all, it was like, was she going to be up for it? Because it's a real test of nerves. to say, okay, will you go and stand by yourself on the stage and sing for 4 minutes by yourself? No, nothing, just naked vocals. Mm. So I had like a daring beginning, and from then on I could, you know, and then it was like, there were certain things I had promised people I would do, you know, there are certain things I had failed at before. I mean, putting The Last Samurai in, I had rewritten and reinvented and recut and re-edited and re-whatever The Last Samurai 4 or 5 times. You know, I really worked hard on it, and it never worked. It took me a really long time to figure out that there's like a favorite part that I finally had to cut out, and that's when it worked. So, you know, sometimes you just have to do that. You just have to go and kill off your favorite part to make things work, to actually get the whole piece in. I mean, to get the piece in. And I mean, you're saying, how did you make the set work? Well, let me answer it like this. Do you know anybody else who can end their set with The Lion King and make the first encore James Bond?
I'm just check my list. No, right. I do not.
I mean, it's not a bad way, you know, to build up to that, you know.
I agree. You mentioned the vocals there. I've seen your live show twice. I saw it once in Wembley a few years ago and once at the O2 earlier this year. The vocalists really get a lot of focus in these shows. It feels like, you know, you really, is that the instrument that you enjoy writing for the most, would you say?
No, it just so happens that Dune was a perfect foil for you know, this extraordinary singer, and Gladiator was really an important thing for the voices. And you saw Wembley when we were doing Angels and Demons, which is a piece which I originally wrote to show that some things are impossible to sing. And then, of course, it's sort of amazing. You write something which at the time is actually impossible to do. You know, it's all about human stamina. It's all about people do need to breathe occasionally. You know, there is that little pesky thing. I know. And then you write it, and then, you know, you have a go at recording it, and it turns out, it really is impossible, you know, and you knew that, you know, and then slowly the choir figures out a way of how to make it possible. So we reinvent not just the music, but we reinvent the way things get to be performed. Or, you know, Guthrie Govan, my amazing guitarist, manages to do, you know. I remember on Dune, asking Guthrie to do something and like, let's just go off into his own world and do his own thing for something. And I got it back, and I gave it to Tina, my cellist, and I said, can you double track this? Can you copy what Guthrie has done? And getting an answer back and her saying, there are notes in there that don't actually exist in the real world. So I'm working on it, but I can't guarantee it, you know. So I love the idea that film music, or that I'm able to take film music and film and put another set of actors in that are the best of the best in the world, you know. And I think that's a really sort of extraordinary thing. It's not just, you know, it's just driving it forward, you know, driving it forward with, you know, having Johnny Marr play guitar, you know. It's like, you know, I don't know. There's something really cool that happens. It's not a guitar. It's Johnny Marr. It's a different thing. It's having another set of actors and another set of artists come and join the film right at the last moment.
What are the instruments that you love playing and hearing in a live show?
Well, I'm a geek. I'm a synth geek. So, you know, it's like there are far too many synthesizers floating around. I mean, it really is embarrassing. And then, I mean, our woodwind player, Pedro Eustache, I mean, Venezuelan, I have, you know, one of the things which is strange about my band is I have a lot of refugees. I have a lot of refugees from different cultures and different continents. And you suddenly realize that Lebo from South Africa, who I first met when he was working in a car wash in LA, is doing a terrible job. He's scratching the shit out of these cars. You know, but he was a political refugee from South Africa. You know, Pedro is a refugee from Venezuela. I mean, you know, it's like a whole orchestra, which we had booked 3 years earlier, was from Odessa in Ukraine. And so 2 weeks before we started rehearsing, the war started, and we managed to get 10 people out. You know, and it so part of what the band's job is, or maybe it's my job, or maybe it's just the way it is to create this sort of haven for, you know, for people whose countries have gone, you know, and become disaster zones. You know, and there's something so wonderful about the not only the cultural mixture, I don't think there are that many bands that have three girl drummers in them. You know, it's just they're not playing because they're girls. They're playing because they're great, because mm-hmm. they're good, they're fantastic. You know, and to just have that mixture of we all speaking in English to each other, and I think there are a few people for whom English is their native tongue, you know, and it's sort of good, because at the end of the day, when we actually get down to it and we start playing music, we really understand each other and we're really speaking the language that we're most comfortable in.
What is most satisfying to you in a live show? An audience member who immediately gets what you're playing, or an audience member who is trying to figure it out for a few seconds because of a new arrangement or because it's fresh?
I've always done this, you know, like, look, Pirates is a pretty popular thing. You
yes,
know?
It is.
So I've always put the main tune at the 14 minutes of everything else, and then you get the tune,
yeah.
You know, which has always been fun because, you know, it's like, is he going to do it? Is he going to do it? Is he going to do it? Yes, I will do it. But, you know, let's get everybody to earn it a little bit. Mm. You know, yes, I don't know. I mean, I want people to enjoy the journey.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? And sometimes if you give everything away right away, it's, you know, what's the point?
Yeah.
You know? Especially because the concert isn't about us, the band. It's about us, everybody in that room. And the audience is as much a participant as the band is. You know, what we get back from the audience is what makes the band good. You know, and I never know what I'm going to say. I've never got anything prepared. So the only way I know how to do this is to treat it like a dinner party, right? You know, we're just having a bit of a chat, right? And I think you probably noticed that, like at Wembley, it's just like, you know, sometimes I rabbit on for like ever, sometimes I got nothing to say, you know, it's like, and sometimes what I say is completely unimportant because, you know, you have a Rosanda play a beautiful violin solo or Tina play a beautiful cello thing and, you know, you're just gobsmacked and you just want to shut up and not take away from the magic of what these people do.
You were talking about encores earlier. You did not mention the second encore that you always do, which is Time. Which is a phenomenal track. I think there's a lot of music that you've done that you can say this of, but especially of Time, that movie has just has transcended the movie and it's become its own beast. I've seen it and heard it in so many different forms and other stuff. Did you have any inkling that it was going to land like that? And when did you first realize that it was landing like that?
There's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of baggage that comes with Time.
Mm.
It took me forever to write. It's only 8 notes, really. You know, actually, it's not even 8 notes. It's like 6 notes and a 7th note or something like this, changes or something. because I needed to get rid of all the wrong notes. Do you know what I mean? It's like all the ones that don't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I finished it, and I was in my studio, and I phoned Chris Nolan, and I said, "Hey, Chris, I think I got something. And can I play it to you over the phone?" And I just, squeezed the receiver under my ear and over my shoulder. I just started playing it to him, and he's like, "Yeah, that's really great. I think that'll be exactly what we need."
Mm.
And then a couple of months went by, and Chris is over at the studio. He's going, "You know that piece you played me over the phone? Whatever happened to it? You never sent it to me." And I realized just playing it to him was like, and him going, "Yeah, I like it," was enough. And I never recorded it.
Wow.
So it nearly got lost. So luckily, Chris said, "Whatever happened to that piece?" And we went, "Oh, you know, okay, fine. We'll I'm recording it now." Right? And then there's this sort of a tragic bit. And the show you saw at Wembley, I think you saw our first show, when I started off as Driving Miss Daisy, right?
Yes.
Right. Okay. So Driving Miss Daisy, I used to have a publicist, Ronnie Trayson, and she was murdered a few years ago. She was just a little old lady stopping a traffic light in the middle of the night in Beverly Hills, and somebody's trying to rob her. And she was one of those feisty little old ladies, so she wasn't having any of it, and the guy shot her. But the first piece of music she ever heard of mine was Driving Miss Daisy, and she came to me and she said, "You're good. I'm going to look after you. I'm going to be your press agent." And the last piece of music she heard was Time, when we were doing Inception. I remember us all being, Chris Nolan and his wife Emma and myself, we were all at some dinner, and Ronnie was there, and Clint Eastwood was there.
Wow.
And Chris was going, "Wow, look, it's Clint Eastwood. I'd love to meet Clint." I said, "No problem. I know Ronnie knows him. Hey, Ronnie, will you take Chris over to meet Clint?" And I saw just, like, I don't know, 10, 20 feet away from me, it's Chris Nolan, the new great, the new great director talking to, the old great director and star Clint, and they're having a lot to talk to each other about. They're obviously fans of each other. And Ronnie's standing next to them, and she's got her hand on her hip, and I'm thinking, there's a dame at the top of her game. It really is it's fantastic to see, she's always been relevant, she's still relevant, and a week later she was dead. So Time always became that last piece I was playing in honor of her. It was really just a personal thing. It was just like my way of always going, I don't want to forget you. You were marvelous. You were wonderful. You helped me have a career. She'd do stuff like, before I would come and do an interview, she'd like grab my chin, look at my face, spit on a handkerchief, clean my face up, tuck my shirt in, and then go, "Just don't say anything stupid, all right?" So I don't have anybody who goes, "Just don't say anything stupid anymore." And I miss that, And she used to come to the kids' birthday parties and stuff like that. So Time's taken on a special meaning, and it's my way of, I play it for the people I love, And funny enough, those people in the audience are now part of, by the end of the show, I hope that they're part of this family. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And I'm open, and you can ask me anything. I will tell you anything, because I think this last tour, this album that we're putting out, the important part about it was, we were the first show that went out while COVID was still raging. We were putting the show together while most countries were saying, "You can't tour yet." And we had booked all these dates hoping that we could, and we did. So we were bringing people together again, which was an important thing. And at the same time, that on the one hand, like on the left hand, there was COVID raging. On the right hand, some maniac started a war in Ukraine. and our orchestra was from Ukraine. So there was this, you know. So behind me, there was all this heaviness of knowing these people suffering, you know, these people playing beautifully for the audience, while really they were dying to get to their phones so that they could see what's happening with the house, what's happening with mom, what's happening with the boyfriend who was called up to go to the front. So constantly real life was interfering, or real life was rearing its ugly head in one way or the other, and at the same time real life was rearing it, you know, its own the beauty of people being together again, you know. So it wasn't as trivial as it could have been. It really felt like there was some human weight that was played for and about every night.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. Can't listen to it again now with that knowledge. I often call film music the link between the head and the heart.
Yeah.
Because it's all about eliciting emotions. And I was wondering, is there an emotion that you enjoy trying to elicit more so than any other?
Yeah, I like scaring the children occasionally. It's always fun. All right, here's my thing. Mm-hmm. And it's you're absolutely right about you know the way you think about music. Mm-hmm. I tell you what is really important to me, because I know I have a very, very big weapon in music. And so what I see music as is just like it's telling you there's a door that I can open, and you are allowed to have an experience. It just says you can have an experience now. Mm. But I don't want you to know. I don't want to dictate what your experience is. I want you to have autonomy. I want you to have control over it. So even if it's a love theme, I want it to be your love theme. I want it to be your experience. I don't want to go and, you know, Ridley Scott used to say to me, sentimentality is unearned emotion, you know, and I think he's absolutely right. And I think it should go one step further, which is a composer shouldn't go and tell you what to feel. He should just give you the possibility to feel, you know. And I think I'm sort of trying to stick to that. And sometimes it would be so much easier to go and just listen. I know how to write a schlocky love theme. Trust me, I know how to do that. But I just don't want to do that. I want to be decent. I want to respect your feelings. I just want to say that. I just want to give you the possibility of having feelings, of feeling something, mm-hmm. because. Bloody hell, we live in a crazy world. I mean, things are really weird. And the one thing I can do is, you know, everybody's working hard and our concerts are not cheap. So our films aren't cheap. So the only thing I can do is when you come and see us, or when you come to one of our movies, you know, I promise you, we worked really hard at trying to do something of quality and distinction. Mm. And we're respecting, you know, how hard you're working. And you can either go and spend a couple of hours in the pub, and or you can come and see us. And I hope we can make the experience at least as good as a pint of beer. Mm. Hopefully a little bit better.
Yeah. Yeah. You were talking earlier about your love of synths. I am a massive fan of a little 1993 movie called Batman Mask of the Phantasm.
Right.
And I just learned that you worked as a synthesizer on that film. What are your memories of that and working with the great Shirley Walker?
I loved her. You know, Shirley was my orchestrator for many years. And I actually fired Shirley out of love. Because she was it was so hard back then. It's still hard for a woman to get a foothold in the composing world. But I knew as long as she was my orchestrator, you know, that it was safe. You know, it was just making decent money. You know, mm-hmm. It was going to be virtually impossible to take the risk and go out there, you know, and be a composer. So I said, Shirley, I love you very much, and that's why I'm firing you, and you're going to go and do your own movies. And if you ever need anybody to go and play synthesizers, I'm available. I'm cheap, you know. So that was the deal. And of course, I loved it. You know, and it's funny because I then ended up doing a Batman movie. And of course, and so it brought a lot of memories back about, mainly about Shirley and me having the opportunity, and I'm going to use it again, saying there was a woman who could write an action cue that could break you in half. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like, there was a woman who knew how she was phenomenal, you know, and I miss her. I mean, she died too young, you know, cancer is a bitch, mm-hmm. Yeah. But if I can say I might have done something good in this life, you know, maybe one of them was firing Shirley so that she would go and write that score that you would enjoy, and you know.
Yeah, and that's when the opening cue with the composers. Yeah. Hans Zimmer, composer of Gladiator, Driving Miss Daisy, Inception, The Dark Knight Rises, and many others, which
we're going to
be here
remember.
All day. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure. It's
been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, there you go. That was Hans Zimmer in conversation with Amon Warman. I particularly loved the bit where Hans, out of nowhere, went full Cockney. Let's hear it again.
Bloody hell.
And again.
Bloody hell.
And one more time, just for good luck.
Bloody hell.
Bloody hell. Hans Zimmer, everybody. And if after that you have been moved to explore Hans in the live arena, so to speak, don't forget that not only is his new album Hans Zimmer Live out in March of next year, and it's available for pre-order right now, but the first single from that, The Last Samurai Suite, is out right now, even as we speak. I forget the name of the film that it's from, but it is a cracking piece of music. And you can check out all of Hans' tour dates and book tickets via HansZimmerLive.com. Okay, that's enough for me. I'm off to, well, I was going to say listen to his score from Dunkirk for a little light relief, but quite frankly, I'm just going to listen to Hans Zimmer saying bloody hell over and over again on a loop. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time. Enjoy.
Bloody hell. Bloody hell. Bloody hell. Bloody hell. Bloody hell. Bloody hell. Bloody hell.